There's a lot of collaboration between ransomware groups, and I'd like to think it's somewhat like a mushroom effect. One group might go down, or one individual within that group might be prosecuted, but then a few more actors spring up over time. So we're definitely seeing a lot of activity in that space.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Mark Thomas, Director of Security Services ANZ from Arctic Wolf. Today, we're discussing the 2023 Arctic Wolf Labs Threat Report. We will be linking a report in the show notes for those wanting to dig a little bit deeper, but Mark, you're here today to sort of walk us through some of the key insights and the main highlights of the report. So thanks for joining, and it's wonderful to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So, Mark, I want to start with now the report. There was the key insights that I wanted to focus on, and one of those was the business email compromise, or BEC, or BEC, depends on who you speak to, attacks that accounted for over a quarter, 29% of Arctic Wolf's incident response cases last year. Talk to me a little bit more about this.
Okay, well, business email compromise is a growing problem that targets organizations of all sizes right across the world. What we found last year was that there was a huge uptick in the number of successful business email compromise attacks that we were asked to engage with our customers on. So for the benefit of your audience, BEC is a type of phishing or social engineering attack where a malicious impersonates a trusted contact. They usually target executives, individuals in finance, payroll, normally in an attempt to trick them into transferring funds, or sometimes can be sensitive information outside the business into an account that's owned by the attacker themselves. But in many cases, a malicious actor, they might manage to compromise an internal account as well. And it tends to impact companies that are more dependent on email. So for example, finance, business services, you know, legal and government, they're usually the ones who are most targeted. But there are different types of variations of the same attack we have seen over the past, you know, 12 months. So, you know, everything from CEO fraud, vendor impersonation, data theft, and even attorney impersonation as well.
Yeah, and these ones are always worrying because, like, once you sort of transferred the money, it's really hard to justify to a bank, like, we were scammed out of the money because you've willingly sent it. And I've worked in a bank historically in security, so I understand that it's always tricky and more of these types of things are happening. But why would you sort of say that these were, like, the dominant attacks? So, I mean, I've spoken to many people on the show and they've each got, you know, differences of services that they provide in terms of insights from a reporting perspective. But I'm curious to know, like, why that's, you know, you've seen an increase then over the last, like, quarter specifically.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of financial and economic concerns at the moment, and business email compromise is a type of, you know, cybercrime itself. And as I said, it poses a large threat to businesses. But based on our engagements, we saw the average loss being about $120,000 Australian, and that was, you know, across all industries. But there are certain industries that are impacted more, like finance, and that can be, you know, upwards of $200,000. But these types of attacks can happen both inside and outside an organization. So, for example, it could be an external perpetrator. It could be someone from, you know, inside the business, an insider threat. And of course, you can have collusion between someone on the inside and the outside as well. But based on our engagements, customers who had called us for, you know, incident response support, they've either been notified from a third party, maybe they've discovered something insidious internally themselves, and they, you know, needed assistance to understand what the scope and impact of that breach was. And I think one of the challenges with business email compromise is it exploits human weaknesses. There may be a lack of technology controls as well within the customers. But we find that these types of attacks are difficult to detect. because they don't always rely on malware. They don't always rely on someone clicking on malicious links. And they tend to target individuals. So it's not always company-wide. So those individuals, not necessarily technology savvy, they may not be security conscious. And I think the other aspect to look at as well is that these types of attacks depend on abusing trust. There might be a sense of urgency involved in the request as well. So if you're an employee in an organization, and you get what looks to be an email from the CEO, the first thing that you want to do is jump on that email, answer right away. And if they're requesting to transfer funds, then you pretty much are going to do that. You're not thinking that email is fraudulent. And I think the other aspect to it as well is just from a general sense, the lack of awareness and education around business email compromise. Even though these types of attacks have been in existence for over a decade now, they're still successful. So I think the message to the audience is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So it's better to stop something bad from happening than it is to deal with it after the fact. So probably the way to address it.
So you mentioned before, Mark, in terms of the collusion on the inside and the outside, or sometimes it's purely inside, sometimes it's purely outside. The collusion on the inside and the outside, that's pretty thought out type of operation. Like, would you say that that's the least common, or is it more so people on the outside that you sort of see business email compromise sort of attacks happening, or is there any sort of insights on that front?
Yeah, so most of the time the attackers are coming from outside, but they may compromise an internal account. So I think at the moment we've seen a lot of data breaches, for example. Maybe your credentials have been leaked online somewhere. So an attacker is able to take those credentials, log on to maybe a VPN or an email system, and then pretend to be that user. But the collusion aspects, we tend to see in the minority of cases. It does happen, but most of the time it's from those external intruders.
Yes, I have spoken on the show before about compromised credentials, for example, but then it's like always hard, where it's like, for example, if I had the compromised credentials, it's going to be like, okay, well, was it Carissa that did it? Because technically it's her that's doing it in terms of like logs. But then it's like, well, actually, it could be compromised credentials. So then it's like, it gets always in that gray area to investigate that more. Because technically all roads are pointing to me, but it may not necessarily be me. Are you sort of seeing a lot of that happening in organizations that are sort of pointing the finger quite quickly to be like, oh, it was Mark, when actually it technically was you, but it wasn't really you, if you get what I mean?
Yeah, I think everyone likes to try to attribute the incident straight away without doing the diagnosis. So I think that's why it's important just to understand what the root point of compromise is. And that's why we're seeing a lot of organizations, reach out to us just to understand, what was that initial attack vector? But most often than not, it is, a compromised credential. Maybe it's exploited vulnerability in remote services, software vulnerabilities, which remain to be unpatched. But the point is that an attacker has been able to get a foothold within the environment. And then from there, they're starting to conduct these business email compromise attacks.
So when you're sort of explaining to a customer, hey, like we've got a foot, the attacker's got a foothold and that's probably why we've had this incident, is alarm bell sort of going off by saying, oh, okay, I didn't think of it like that? Or like what's sort of the feedback that you're getting? Because I mean, it is alarming. And it's a little bit different when it's like, oh, someone accidentally like clicked on a phishing link, for example. But when you're sort of saying like this compromised credentials for whatever reason, like that's, there's probably a little bit more going on there. And then you're probably thinking, sitting back saying, okay, well, where else have they gone? What else is going on?
Exactly right. I mean, it could really be the tip of the iceberg. So you might find, for example, that yes, it has been a compromised credential and there has been a business email compromise. But after you do the incident response engagement, you might find that the attacker has embedded themselves within that organization. So they may have already compromised data. They have moved laterally, maybe they've escalated privileges. So it can, what can start out as a smaller problem can actually end up being a much larger challenge to deal with. And I think that's why it's really important for organizations to work with trusted advisors on the matter, because these types of incidents can be really complex to deal with, especially if you don't have the right set of resources internally to deal with it.
Yeah, most definitely. Absolutely right. So there was another highlight in your report that 58% of victim organizations failing to have MFA or multi-factor authentication enabled. So 58%, like that's pretty high. So I'm curious to know, like, why is that high?
Yeah, and this one took us by surprise as well. We didn't expect to see that many organizations either lacking MFA or just haven't configured it correctly. But I think in part, you know, budgets do come up. It can be somewhat cost prohibitive. So that can be a major deterrent when there are other competing IT projects looking for that share of spend. Certainly, there are less mature organizations within the SMB space as well that often think that they have existing password policies and practices and they're probably good enough. So for example, some customers think that just by increasing password length or complexity, that will help do the trick, which is constantly changing password. But we know that's really not good enough to deal with, you know, identity-based attacks. On the other side of things as well, some organizations may have had multi-factor authentication deployed, but they hadn't configured all of their users and applications onto it as well. Possibly, you know, the other perspective that we can look at it is from a productivity and an efficiency point of view, where yes, there might be somewhat of an inconvenience if you have MFA, because if you're now authenticating to a website or to an application, you have to enter something you have, maybe a password, maybe you need to have your mobile device with you, you have to enter a token code. So it might be, you know, slowing some users down. So that's I think another reason. But, you know, traditionally what we found is that SMBs likely, you know, invest less in security best practices compared to, you know, enterprise partners. And that's beginning to change, I think, with the rise of publicized data breaches, media scrutiny, much more broad oversight than there used to be. And of course, we've seen a lot more done from a mandatory incident reporting perspective as well.
So when you say invest less, do you think it's just that they don't have the budgets to do it, the board's not agreeing that they should have more money for security? I mean, it's an ongoing battle that especially SMBs seem to face. Would you say it's more on that front, or do you think that they're just not like willing to invest like in an MFA sort of solution, for example?
It's a combination of multiple factors. So, you know, budgets do play a huge part of that. If you don't have budgets, then you can't invest in, you know, people and the latest and greatest technology out there. But, you know, it's not always about investing in, you know, a huge amount of point products. What we find is that a lot of our customers, they're just looking to simplify their technology stack because they don't have that same level of investment in security. So I think it does require executive oversights. You need to bring in a culture of security within the organization. But obviously having the right people to tackle the problem is really challenging for SMBs in particular, right? Because they can't afford to pay the, you know, the six-figure salaries that some of the, you know, banking organizations can.
So you mentioned before simplify technology stack. What do you mean specifically when you're saying that?
Well, what we find is that a lot of customers have invested in, you know, 20 to 50 different point products. They may be best of breed. They may be served a purpose once upon a time, but those organizations don't have the personnel, the resources to be able to manage all of that technology because it's constantly changing. You know, updates have to be applied, and that is a huge burden to the organization. Whereas it's probably, you know, security is not really their core business. So what we're finding is that they want to have a unified view of their security posture, but also looking to offload some of those security controls that they've invested in by better maximizing the use of more modern technologies.
Yeah, and I totally get that. I think there was a guy I was interviewing in the UK. I think he said there's some organizations that they looked at that were using like 70 to 80 different tools. Like that's a lot, which is overwhelming. So do you think that maybe I get the reasoning of trying to consolidate like your tech stack and your vendors, et cetera, but then do you think it's doing a disservice because you are trying to consolidate, but then maybe I'm not saying you need all of these tools. It's just more so you're trying to consolidate, but then it does a disservice anyway. So I'm just sort of seeing it from both sides.
Yeah, a lot of the modern security technologies have a lot of the features and functions that all of these point solutions used to have. So what we'll often find is there are certain technologies that you can just enable, the features and functions on, which displace other products that you've already invested in. But what we find is that organizations just really want to get that unified view across that technology stack so that they know where to invest their time and their money to improve their security posture. Because it's not true that the more security technologies you have, the better off you are from a security resilience perspective. That actually can be one of the problems of why organizations are struggling with tackling cyber threats, because they can't manage everything. So certainly in the SMB space, it's just understanding what they have, investing in the right technologies, and making sure they get to that end-to-end visibility.
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying. Like that's pretty overwhelming, especially like, I don't know, someone's working in a company, they've brought in X tool or vendor and then they leave and people might not even know that it's even there. So it can be overwhelming for people to manage that. So just quick question on the MFA from the user experience point of view. Now, I know that in security, we've always said that, we trade convenience for security, but do you think that that is like a major factor in that percentage being so high in terms of 58%? Or would you say all of the reasons you gave before is probably evenly distributed?
I'd say less from a productivity and efficiency perspective. Once people get educated on the importance of identity protection, they begin to realize the overall business benefits. But I think, from what we're seeing, it's more about, having budget to begin with and enrolling users and applications within the MFA technology itself.
Now, I want to sort of switch gears now and talk about Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year that happened. Now, in your report, you guys are sort of saying that that significantly disrupted the activity of threat actor groups in both countries and influenced a 26% year-on-year decline in observed ransomware cases globally. So super curious about this one. So would you say that number is due to increase over this year and so on, or decrease? Or, I mean, I know you're not Nostradamus, but I mean, it'd be cool to sort of get some indication from yourself, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, predictions are always hard to make, but I think this was a temporary aberration. What we find is that ransomware operators always, look to relocate. They might replatform, retool, but they'll always go about targeting, right? Already we've seen from the evidence coming out of North America that ransomware operators are still very much active. And you just have to look at some of the macro factors at the moment, right? We still have geopolitical issues, there's recession fears, financial cost of living pressures as well. So from a Russia and Ukraine incursion perspective, there is a need for money to fund that invasion and even support weapons development programs. And that's not just limited to Russia, but North Korea as well. They have to make up for recent shortfalls in revenue caused by supply chain disruptions, banking sanctions, which excluded Russia from the SWIFT payment network. And cyber is used as a weapon by governments to help overcome some of these challenges. It's far more easy and cost effective to conduct cyber operations to steal and launder funds. And they can do that using somewhat minimal resources that can be carried out remotely and at scale. The other side of the coin there is that we are still seeing ransomware as a service. That's a thriving market. And that essentially lowers the barrier to entry for cybercrime. Any amateur can leverage the tools and services available on dark web. I do expect that become even more prominent in the future with the likes of AI and automation, which makes it far more simple to carry out as well. And then the other point from a customer perspective as well, we know that they're expanding their footprints, they're adopting, you know, new technologies, they're migrating to the cloud. We have a remote workforce these days. All of that creates complexities. And with complexities comes vulnerabilities, right? You lack that visibility. It can be difficult to manage all of the technology because you can't secure what you don't know exists. And if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So I think SMBs here are seen as a soft target for adversaries who might look to cause damage to either individuals or, you know, companies and disrupt supply chains as well. And we feel that SMBs have somewhat been underserved within the industry. But even though they're smaller organizations, they still face the same set of challenges that enterprises face. But as I said before, I think, you know, part of that is, you know, a resourcing problem. Here in Australia, for example, 97% of businesses are small business. So they're really the backbone of our economy. I think it does present a huge challenge for them.
So going back to the ransomware as a service, and as you sort of alluded to before, that, you know, it's a lower barrier to entry, like you don't, you know, back in the day you had to somewhat really know the stuff inside and out, but now you don't really need to know that. So would you sort of predict there's going to be a rise of this? And yes, because of the low barrier to entry, but then also because, like, now people are trying to find ways to, you know, work from home, and there's all these scams, like, you know, going out on like job boards and things like that by saying like, oh, like if you can earn money from home by, you know, doing X, Y, and Z, something obviously cyber criminal related. But would you say we're going to see an increase in that now? And also, like you mentioned before, around the cost of living and things like that, you know, sometimes people do these things because they're desperate or whatever it is. Will we start to see this sort of creep up, or what do you think?
Yeah, so I definitely think we're going to see this rise as well. And as I mentioned, AI, automation, these types of technologies add more fuel to the fire. You know, ransomware as a service, it's actually designed for any person to leverage. So you don't have to be, you know, an advanced malware developer or, you know, penetration tester to be involved. You could actually share a cut of the campaign, you know, ransom funds these days. There are particular groups who look to employ affiliate partners. So I definitely think this is something that will continue to be on the rise as we see further adoption of ransomware affiliation programs get rolled out across the globe. And, you know, I think given there are a lot of challenges in the macro environment, that's only going to compound the problem exponentially.
Yeah, most definitely. So would you say, like, in your sort of experience and field of work, that because we are going to see this rising more, that's going to put more pressure then back on organizations or SMBs, because, like, it's hard enough to keep up with what's, like, going on, and now we're going to have this additional sort of workforce from a ransomware as a service also targeting businesses as well, that perhaps people historically didn't have to factor in. You know, it's sort of a bit more organized crime or people with, like, specialized skill sets. Now it's like, okay, we can just roll it out to anyone potentially trying to, like, attack us now. Would you say, like, that's going to put more pressure back on organizations?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we actually conducted a survey for Australian business leaders late last year. And we found that they were challenged with the inability to keep up with advanced threats. They also say that they're, you know, lacking budget to do so. And over one in three were willing to pay a ransom to resume business operation.
Mm.
But from a people side of things, you know, security teams are already overwhelmed, right? They have a lot of alerts coming in. You know, there's data deluge. So we also have to be mindful of the challenge that we'll face. It's not all about, you know, technology alone. So, I mean, this is the here and present challenge that organizations face, is attracting talent and making sure that they can sustain people for the long term, because they tend to be overwhelmed with the scope of the problem.
Yeah, most definitely. Absolutely right. Now, Lockbit established itself as the dominant ransomware group, according to your report. So perhaps, Mark, for those who are unfamiliar, just maybe give a bit of an overview of this group and what they're doing.
Okay, so ransomware groups, you know, they're many in nature. Lockbits is one of the most prolific ones out there. They've been around since about 2019. They claim not to be politically motivated, but I think there are a lot of signs that they are. Over the last few years, have, you know, estimated to extract tens of millions of dollars from various organizations through ransomware, but the claims probably add up to over 100 million. From our research, when we, you know, pulled together the report, we saw that there was over 800 plus different victims we, you know, noticed on dark web sites. In terms of who they target, this can be a wide variety of businesses, regardless of size, but predominantly, you know, manufacturing, wholesale, finance, education, they've all been victimized. In terms of the locations where they actually target, again, historically, it's from all over the world, but the majority of which we see to fall within the United States, France, Italy. We've even seen them operate targeting Australian businesses too, anywhere from legal firms, healthcare, gaming. How this type of ransomware group targets their victims, it's normally through vulnerable remote access servers, unpatched critical vulnerabilities. We mentioned before credential stuffing and insider access. But once they're in an organization, they'll detonate their ransomware, they'll encrypt data, they may drop a ransom note with instructions on how to pay for that ransom. Normally that's through the likes of Tor, encrypted and anonymized application. And you have to pay them via cryptocurrency. I think Bitcoin is their currency of choice. And if you don't pay, then they'll just name and shame you on their data leak site. And it's something that's cropping up a lot more. But they're kind of known because the way that they've set up their business mirrors a traditional or a legitimate business itself. We mentioned before affiliate programs. They work with what's called initial access brokers. So any individual who's capable of entering an organization could be through exploitation, it could be, you know, a very targeted means, but they have, you know, administrators, people who look after the infrastructure that they support, and they'll share a cut of any ransom with any of their affiliates as well. And what we know from the past is that this type of group, they actually recruit in different languages as well. So it could be Russian, it could be Chinese, it could be in English. But what we found is that they're continuing to develop new malware each and every year, you know, new features and functions. So it is a persistent, so organizations really have to be aware of.
Yeah, I was literally interviewing someone yesterday about this group and the affiliates. So this is definitely worrying. And just sort of to press on that maybe a little bit more, from my understanding that, you know, once a ransomware group like Lockbit, for example, like gets a lot more eyes and then they sort of like dissolves, not the right word, but they sort of go a little bit more silent because they know that a lot of people are, you know, monitoring them and auditing them and whatever else. So do you think that a lot of these ransomware groups sort of like not come and go, but like they pop up for a bit and then obviously there's too many people looking at them and then they sort of go back down a little bit like duck diving, or they go and, you know, work with other ransomware groups, for example? Are you sort of seeing that from your point of view?
Yeah, there's a lot of collaboration between ransomware groups, and I'd like to think it's somewhat like a mushroom effect. One group might go down, or one individual within that group might be prosecuted, but then a few more actors spring up over time. So we're definitely seeing a lot of activity in that space. Last year, there was a dip probably because of the Russian incursion into Ukraine,
yeah,
where different members of that group might have to relocate somewhere else. But, you know, we're already starting to see activity within Australia. I think from last time I checked, there was about 5 victims in this year alone.
So then on that note, would you say that Lockbit, we're going to see more sort of increase of attacks coming from then, like in Australia, but more broadly than across the globe?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're already seeing activity from them in the last couple of weeks in the US. But there have been some positive developments with regards to Lockbit. I know the last year they themselves suffered a breach. One of their malware developers released one of their executables online. Apparently it was because they were upset with their own leadership team, which I think was quite funny. But also
absolutely. Wow. So it was intentional. It was an accident.
It was absolutely intentional. They wanted to take down the group, I think, as well. But what we've also seen is that the FBI conducted an investigation, a counter-offense initiative, and that did culminate in the arrest of one dual Russian-Canadian, and that was in Canada themselves. So we know that, you know, that takedowns and disruptions will occur, but we don't expect the group to be completely disbanded. And we've already seen that the team take on new malware tools the last couple of months as well. So we do expect to see more activity. The ransomware won't stop, but there is certainly, you know, some positive developments coming out of the US at the moment.
So there's a couple of things in there that you said. Do you know sort of like how big this group is? Like how many people are involved? Like I know that, I mean, it's a bit of a hard question, but I'm just genuinely curious, like hundreds, thousands, like how big are these guys?
So it's difficult to know how big the core team is, but we have seen the number of ransomware affiliates, so the people that they work with, and they can be, you know, individual, mm-hmm. they can be, you know, groups themselves,
yeah.
that has numbered in the hundreds.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of people. So, I mean, you think about how easy it is for one person to conduct an attack at scale and to have these people, you know, proactively targeting businesses, whether they're large or small, that creates an exponential effect.
I know this, like, if you were to be, if you were to conduct ransomware, like, as a group, not that you would, you'd probably want to be on the affiliate end then, wouldn't you? Probably, like, less risk involved, would you say?
I think there's a lot of risk if you're an affiliate. I think it's better to stay in the background as the core team members aren't, because if you're all an affiliate, you're the one going out and getting access and detonating some of the malware within these organizations. So you're more likely to be found out and apprehended. So, you know, if I was a member of a ransomware group, probably the core team is trying to stay far removed from where the detonation actually takes place, because that will ensure their own sustainability.
Yes, sorry, you absolutely are right. So then why would someone opt for being an affiliate then? Or is it going to come down to like skill set, like you said before, like it's a lower barrier for entry, like you don't have to necessarily know all the ins and outs of things. Like why would someone, if you're in a more riskier position, why would you want to be in that riskier position? Wouldn't you want to be the people in the back, like you mentioned before?
Yeah, so the reason why people decide to be, you know, an affiliate is because they don't have to develop malware. They don't have to manage all of the infrastructure and support behind it. All they have to do is just go off and detonate the malware themselves. So it's far easier for them just to execute a program and, you know, don't have to worry about all the technical skills that go behind the scenes to manage an ongoing campaign. And they also get a share of any ransom funds as well.
Yeah, no, I totally hear what you're saying. So I guess it's sort of like these like large drug syndicates, like, you know, the person top dog, you know, saying here's all his, you know, affiliates doing the actual running of a drug operation. If you're the person on the ground, like driving between like US, Canada or something, like that's way more riskier. But I guess, like you said, like they have to set it all up and they have more of the overhead. So I guess I do understand why people would be, you know, on that affiliate end, because they don't want to have all that overhead, but I guess there's just more risk.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And unfortunately, it's those ransomware affiliates who tend to be the ones who are apprehended. It's not generally the core team. So this is why we tend to see the survivability of ransomware groups over time.
So going back to that individual that you mentioned before, that you said deployed some of the executable programs or whatever it was online. What do you think ever happened to that person? Because I mean, it's a pretty bold thing. Like, you're dealing with criminals, right? Like, it wasn't like, oh, I've done something incorrectly and I've been slapped over the wrist or I got fired from it. Like, there could be severe sort of ramifications from that. So like, did you ever sort of figure out like what happened to that person or?
So this was only brought to the courts end of last year. So they still have to plead their case. So I imagine they're still coming up with a lot of information to try to defend themselves. But the FBI normally only conducts these types of takedown operations if it knows it's got some type of critical information linking that individual back to an operation. And there has to be a victim at the heart of all of this as well. So it's something that we'll just have to continue to watch for.
And do you think that person's potentially now they've been exempt from any sort of prosecution because they're now be like, oh, they can use the FBI can like leverage that person potentially. Well, probably less so because it's obvious that they've, deployed this stuff online. Would you say that there is some element of that of people being exempt from, any sort of jail time or anything like that because they are then cooperating with the FBI and friends?
Well, I don't know if they have been cooperating. But it's certainly an option. I mean, it would be an option that law enforcement would provide to the alleged group member. And if that does happen, then there's probably a pretty good opportunity. You'd start to build up more of an intelligence profile about other actors within that group, understanding more about their tactics and techniques that they're engaging in as well. So hopefully that will lead to a better outcome for organizations with a complete takedown of the ransomware group altogether. And I think we'll probably have to watch this space.
And like you said, they just keep popping up like mushrooms. There'll be someone else that pops up again. So what about looking forward? Like, I know we've gone into specific details and certain things in terms of stats and Lockbit, but do you have any sort of insights for executives and advice that you can sort of share with people today, like as a result of some of the work that you are doing at Arctic Wolf and then also some of the cases that you are sort of seeing? What can you sort of leave our audience with today?
Well, I think firstly, if anyone's listening to this podcast, I think anyone's doing the right thing, and that's getting educated on subject matter. Also understanding that security shouldn't be seen as a technical issue, but it's a business problem. And we have to break out of this cycle of fear and uncertainty and recognize that organizations don't have a tools problem, as we've discussed. It's more of an operational one. And businesses can't tackle these problems in isolation. It's far too challenging. So they have to address security from a holistic perspective. Focusing on people and technology who are working together to help in cyber risk. It can't be just one or the other. It's all about how you can better leverage your existing resources to achieve the outcomes that you want. So I think if you can get the security operations piece right, then that will help to reduce the likelihood of an incident, minimize the impact of a breach, and ultimately that will help to build resilience for the long term. But always look to work with trusted advisors. If you don't have the skill sets internally, make sure that you're speaking the common language of risk within the business. And that's hopefully expressed in terms of financials and value at risk as well. But if you build a culture of security awareness, you help to enforce security at the people level. And that's really one of the lines of defenses that organizations have.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Mark. I think this has been a really interesting chat, definitely in terms of the reports and the stats that we sort of touched on today. And then also like the Lockbit stuff. I'd be keen to sort of like get you back to find out what happened to that individual and see what happened and see how Lockbit's sort of progressing. So thanks so much for your time and your insights and coming on the show today.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MERCSEC, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MERCSEC.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.